Well, good evening, brethren. How's everybody doing tonight? All right, let's begin with a prayer. Oh God, thank you for this evening and all the blessings and experiences, whether good or bad, that we've had today, that they might teach us always to walk in your ways, trusting in your teachings and obeying your commands, that we might be everything that you want us to be. Please help us, oh God, to continue to do those things, that we may gain a heart of wisdom, that we may know how we ought to live each and every day. And Father, as we consider more about this earth and how you have designed it, indeed how you have designed the entire universe for life, we want to be able to think about these things and see how we can teach them to the people around us, especially anyone who may ask us a question, simply because of the fact they know that we're church members. And so they believe in their hearts that they can ask us questions about creation or the Bible or whatever. May we thus be prepared to answer them. In the name of Jesus we pray. Amen. Before I get on, we're talking about the anthropic principle. Before I get to that, I want to show you a video. I subscribe to a magazine called Answers. And this is put out by the same people who have given us the Creation Museum back there in Kentucky. It's a very good magazine, by the way, if you ever want to get a good stuff on evolution, creation, that kind of stuff. It comes out every other month. But when you're a subscriber, they also send you an email every time a new issue comes out so that you can go online to their website and download some more stuff or watch a video or whatever. And the video that they sent with the most recent issue, I thought was real good, and I wanted to show that. Rick, can you just turn off all those lights, please? It's going to make a loud hum at first.
Now, here's a little bird. That's got to be the world's greatest navigator.
The Pacific Golden Plover is a shorebird which lives in the great Arctic North. Weighing only half a pound, lays about four eggs that hatch in 24 days. After having its chicks, this bird embarks on a courageous and Herculean migration.
How does evolution explain how a migratory animal gets from where he is in the summer to where he is in the winter? Usually the explanation is you have this certain kind of bird, and he grows in Texas. And then one winter, Texas is a cold winter. So he decides, you know something, I'm heading for Mexico. So he flies a few hundred miles south, and it's a little nicer down here. And then he comes back to Texas in the summer, but it's an especially hot summer. So he decides, you know, I think I'm going to go to Kansas. So he flies north, looking for a little cooler weather. And then each year, he might go a little further south, a little further north, until they get all the way up to the Arctic and all the way down to South America. Well, this little bird breaks that rule. First of all, it's a very small bird, about the size of a dove, and it's not a swimmer, and it lives up in the Arctic, in Alaska, actually. They leave their young, and then fly to Hawaii for the winter. Now, when it leaves Alaska, it has an 88-hour flight nonstop because there's no land in between. 3 days and four nights nonstop. How does it do that? Well, these little birds begin to eat a lot, and they gain about 70 grams of burnable energy. And here's the problem. We got an 88-hour flight, and they burn right at 1 gram per hour. Well, that only gives them 70 hours worth of fuel. So they're going to drop into the ocean as non-swimmers a few hours short of Hawaii. Well, then how do they get there? Well, because God made them, so they fly in formation, and they alternate leaders, and so they break the air over there, so it makes it easy, like geese fly in formation. And that cuts the energy that it takes to fly.
It's not uncommon for birds of that size to lose 50% of their total body weight. And that's fat being burned up along the migration route. It's an incredible feat. If you can imagine a 100-pound human losing 50 pounds in a 5-day period as they travel across the world. It's something that mammals can't do.
And so, only God could do that, because the evolutionary explanation doesn't fit, because there's no way they can go a little bit each year, a little bit further south, plop, their fish bait. Okay, so they can't do it. So the evolutionary explanation doesn't work on them. There is another interesting thing, and that is that the parents have their eggs, the babies hatch, but then the parents fly to Hawaii. Now the young are here, and they're going to keep eating and growing and gaining strength to get their 70 grams of fat built up. And then they take off for Hawaii, but they've never been there before. So how do they navigate? How do they know where to go? Nobody knows for sure. And if they miss it, even if some side wind would catch them and start blowing them off course, they still get there.
And they can arrive at the exact same location every year, within an area the size of this room, and they do this over thousands of miles.
How do these animals get from here to there? The scientists are still trying to figure that out. Same thing with the homing pigeons. These little birds can find their way back home to their very spot where they need to go from almost anywhere in the world. Now, there are these huge areas that they've never flown over before.
So they use many means, and we don't even really know what they all are and how they do it, but when we take them out and release them, they'll circle for a while and get oriented and head for home.
What is guiding them across these areas? And what is built into them that God has done? I think that's the only way to describe it, is God has made these little creatures so they can find their way over totally unknown territory to them. What a wonderful, magnificent thing God has done.
Okay, if I could have the lights back on. And then, Chris, do you know how to turn off that sound fan there? Well, okay, it's really easy. Just like you're sitting in front of it, and then reach down by your right thigh on the inside, and you'll sit down. See, there you go. You got it. All right. Thank you. Okay. That sounds nice. Have your children in Alaska and then leave them and go to Hawaii. How come I wasn't the golden plover? Man. Did you think that was interesting? Man, I sure did. When I saw that, I thought, wow, that's fascinating. And as you saw at the very end there, that's just a small part of a larger video series. So I thought I got to show this to the brethren. To me, it was irresistible. Okay, so let me now review quickly what we've been looking at. Who made the earth just right for life? Have you heard of the anthropic principle? And we'll see what it is here in just a moment. Remember that word anthropic? You've heard of anthropology, that's the study of man, the study of mankind. So this here says, we're talking about the idea that the earth and the universe were designed with man in mind. Okay? And I began by saying, if God does not exist, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die, 1 Corinthians 15:32. But if God does exist, let us pray and obey, for tomorrow we meet God. All right? The universe did not get here accidentally. I know there's people that say that, but I don't see how that's possible. Therefore, something caused the universe. What was it? The universe has evidence of design. Therefore, someone designed it. And the question is, who was it? The universe has the purpose of sustaining life. Therefore, someone wants us here. Why does he want us here? And that's where I believe the Bible comes in. The Bible answers that question for us. Okay, so I showed you last week some quotes from secularists that they affirm the anthropic principle. These are people who do not necessarily believe in God. All right? So I found some of these quotes in the November 29th issue, 2004, of Time magazine, which is by no means a friend of creation, okay? So they had this article, Cosmic Conundrum, and you saw where I have some quotes circled there, and here they are in bigger print. The universe seems uncannily well-suited to the existence of life. Could that really be an accident? So I'm thrilled to see them asking that question. And they're going to talk about why the universe, against all odds, is so remarkably hospitable to life. And that's true, is it not? I mean, does life grow here or not? If you're not sure, whatever fruits or vegetables you have in your house, just throw them outside and watch what happens. And soon life will start growing on it, or life will come and eat it. You know, it just happens so easily, okay? Some more quotations. Without star debris like this, life would not be possible. You know, is that further evidence that God created the universe just for us? Still further in the article, many of the most fundamental characteristics of our cosmos are so finely tuned that if just one of them were even slightly different, life as we know it couldn't exist. And we're talking about thousands, maybe even millions of these things. Not just one or two, like gravity or the distance of the Earth from the sun, or how long our days are, you know, whether our bodies can absorb nutrition. I mean, you can just go on and on with the list. It's not just a few things, okay? The proposition that the cosmos is, against all odds, perfectly tuned for life is known as the anthropic principle. And by the way, I don't know if I told you or not, but I want to start a website dealing with this issue. And I went online and noticed that theanthropicprinciple.com is not claimed by anyone in the world yet. So I'm thinking about buying it. It'll only be $26 or maybe $100 or something. So change one thing, the strength of gravity, say, and life might not, or might be impossible. The anthropic principle still makes many scientists uncomfortable, not just because it gives comfort to theologians or believers like you and me. That discomfort, says Stanford theorist Leonard Susskind, is all to the good. In the end, he observed, it doesn't matter whether the anthropic principle makes us happy. What matters is whether it's true. This gentleman, Heinz Oberhammer, I am not a religious person, but I could say this universe is designed very well for the existence of life. And notice that he's at the University of Vienna in Austria, his astrophysicist. So he's not, again, not necessarily a creation-friendly universe or even nation where he lives. Now, this is where we left off, okay? So now, let's go to Job 12 and see that the Bible affirms this anthropic principle. Job 12. And remember, you know, Job is in a debate with his friends. They're convinced that he's committed some great sin that has brought on all his suffering, and he doesn't know what it is. He would like to know, but of course he doesn't know the debate that God and Satan had behind the scenes, and that really it's all about him and whether he will curse God when he loses everything. Okay, so in chapter 12, he begins to answer back to Zophar, who had spoken in chapter 11. Let me just go back to verse 1. I love the way this reads. Then Job answered and said, "No doubt you are the people, and wisdom will die with you." Was he a little sarcastic there or what? "But I have understanding as well as you. I am not inferior to you. Indeed, who does not know such things as these?" But then he says, you know, I'm being mocked by my friends. And then he says in verse 7, "But now ask the beast and they will teach you, and the birds of the air and they will tell you, or speak to the earth and it will teach you, and the fish of the sea will explain to you. Who among all these different creatures in nature, does not know that the hand of the Lord has done this? In whose hand is the life of every living thing, and the breath of all mankind. Does not the ear test foods and the mouth taste its food? Wisdom is with aged men and with the length and with length of days understanding. All right, now let's look at the next one, which is Psalm 104. Now, Psalm 104 is significant because it reveals to us some of what happened to the earth after Noah's flood. Can the earth ever be flooded with water again? I mean, the whole planet? No. Why? Because God promised it. And he did something to the earth to make sure it'll never happen again. Okay? What was that?
Rainbow.
Well, that's a sign that he'll never do it again. That's right. What was that?
Mountains came up and made barriers, what you call it.
Exactly, right. So we're going to be looking at verse 10, but I want you to back up for a moment. Look at verse 5. You who laid the foundations of the earth so that it should not be moved forever, you covered it with the deep as with a garment. The waters stood above the mountains. At your rebuke, they fled. At the voice of your thunder, they hastened away. They went up over the mountains, or the mountains rose up and the valley sank down to the place which you founded for them. You have set a boundary that they may not pass over, that they may not return to cover the earth. So that tells me that the land that's visible on the earth was not as rugged before the flood as it is now. The mountains were not as high, and the valleys were not as low. So he dropped the valleys down even more, rose up the mountains, brought up the Rockies, the Appalachians, you know, the Cascades, and just brought up the whole land as a whole so that it just can't happen, unless, of course, he wanted to do it. But he's promised that he won't do it. Okay, so now look at verses 10 through 15. He sends the springs into the valleys. They flow among the hills. They give drink to every beast of the field. The wild donkeys quench their thirst. Now, before we go any further, do you see what the psalmist is saying? He's telling you that God has designed everything, especially the way he deals with water, for what purpose? Just in those first two verses. What was that? Well, who's thirst? Every beast, and then he even specifies the wild donkeys. By them, the birds of the heavens have their home. They sing among the branches. He waters the hills from his upper chambers. The earth is satisfied with the fruit of your works. He causes the grass to grow for the cattle and vegetation for the service of man, that he may bring forth food from the earth and wine that makes glad the heart of man, oil to make his face shine, and bread which strengthens man's heart. Okay, so God's providing all these things for the animals of the earth, including us. Okay, so this earth is just, the main thing that it's talking about, I think, is just the nutrition, the food supply that's here. It should make it obvious that someone wants there to be living creatures here. I don't mean just plants, but animals and people. Otherwise, why did he put all this food here? Whereas he didn't anywhere else, as far as we know. Okay, let's look at the next one. Isaiah 45. Verse 12, God says, I have made the earth and created man on it. I, my hands, stretched out the heavens and all their host I have commanded. Verses 18 and 19. For thus says the Lord who created the heavens, who is God, who formed the earth and made it, who has established it, who did not create it in vain, who formed it to be inhabited. I am the Lord, and there is no other. I have not spoken in secret in a dark place of the earth. I did not say to the seed of Jacob, seek me in vain. I, the Lord, speak righteousness. I declare things that are right. Okay, so notice verse 18 especially. Why does God say he created the earth?
To be inhabited.
Okay, well, we would gather that that means everything that is living here. He made the earth so that all those things could live here. But then I think he specifies one particular creature in verse 19. And who's that particular creature?
Jacob.
Jacob, or man.
Seed of Jacob.
Yeah. Think about the earth, how it's just perfect for us to live here. Have you ever noticed them? I don't know if you like to watch sci-fi movies or not, science fiction, but yeah, I do. And one of the things that's interesting is, whenever they travel to another planet, they just walk right out, and do whatever. As though that place has the right amount of air, the right amount of gravity, and everything else that is needed for life. Of course, if you had to make every movie like 2001, A Space Odyssey, it's kind of slow going. I mean, I think that was a fabulous movie, but they tried to deal with gravity and, all that kind of stuff, if you've seen that movie. But just think about that for a while. Okay? Think about how Earth is perfectly suited to sustain life here. Not just Earth, but our solar system. I mean, we benefit from the moon. We benefit from the sun. There's so many things that benefit us. All the stars in the sky. Even Genesis 1 mentions that and why God gave those. Phil?
It's like those astronauts went up to the moon, looked back at Earth and said how beautiful it is. How God put everything in order.
Right.
It couldn't have happened unless it was in order. Like you say, one little thing out of something else.
That's right. And if you remember one of those quotations I had from Time Magazine there, they talked about the cosmos, which I always think that's so interesting because the word cosmos means order as opposed to chaos. And if you remember, I told you about cosmetics, that comes from order, bringing order to disorder is what that is. So, but it's interesting that they would talk about order. This is an ordered place. How can you have order without an orderer? Is that a word? If not, I just invented it. Alexander Haig used to do it all the time. I don't know if you remember him or not. So if he could do it, I can do it. Okay, the next one is Matthew chapter 6. Does everybody remember Alexander Haig? Secretary of State during the Reagan administration. Okay. He was funny. He was a good guy, though. Okay. Matthew 6, verse 26. Look at the birds of the air, for they neither sow nor reap nor gather into barns, yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Now, isn't that amazing? Isn't it amazing that there just happens to be the thousands of different kinds of birds that there are, and they all have available to them the food they need and the materials they need for building their homes or nests or whatever? Well, the point that Jesus is making is God has arranged this whole thing. He's arranged for the eagle to be able to live in a certain place and made materials available to the eagle so it can build its massive nests. The birds that are on bridges, are those swallows? Is that right? I can just go on and on with all the examples of just how everything just seems to be provided for everyone. Okay, look at verse 28. Same thing here. So why do you worry about clothing? Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin. Now there Jesus didn't come right out and say it like he did in verse 26. But is he not also implying the same thing, that God is the one who did this? Isn't that his point? And of course, the greater point that he's getting to is, if God does all this for the birds and the flowers, then he'll do it for us. Well, speaking of, you know, remember I used these passages Sunday night? Y'all remember that? I was talking about do not be anxious for your life. And I was talking about the flowers. And just how significant they are. But we're so used to seeing them that we really don't take it into account. But then I said, now if we discovered a flower on Mars, what a big deal that would be, and everyone would notice that. And did you all see what was in the news the next day? You saw that? Okay, so here's the rover that we just sent up there, and it's going along, and it finds something in the dirt that they're calling a flower. It cracked me up when I saw that. Of course, they know it's not a real flower. It's some kind of, well, I don't know, what would you call it? Is it a metal? Is it a gem? I don't know what it is, okay? But it just cracked me up. Here they found a flower on Mars, the way they announced it. Okay, verse 30. Now, if God so clothes the grass of the field, which today is, and tomorrow is thrown into the oven, will he not much more clothe you, O you of little faith? All right, so God created the birds, and he created the environment for the birds. God created the flowers, and he created the environment for the flowers. God created man, and he created an environment for man. That's the anthropic principle. The cosmos, the earth especially, has been designed by someone so that we can live here. In Acts 14, 17. Okay, Paul here is speaking to the people of Lystra, and he's performed a miracle. They think he's a god. So they begin to get ready to sacrifice to him and Barnabas. Verse 15, Paul and Barnabas stop the people from doing that. You know, they're saying, we're trying to tell you to turn from these vain things. Don't worship something that's not God. Instead, worship the true God. And here's why. Verse 17. Nevertheless, he did not leave himself without witness in that he did good, gave us rain from heaven and fruitful seasons, filling our hearts with food and gladness. Okay, so Paul says that God left a witness on the earth to say that there really is a creator God in heaven. What is that witness? What was that?
Nature.
And he specifies some things. Doing us good, specifically even more, giving us rain and fruitful seasons, filling our hearts with food and gladness. Dave?
Them the need to know what they knew it in intuitively, what they were had to do. Man had to learn a whole bunch of things. He gave them hands and so forth. He was able to make tools. He not only created man to make get by in the garden for a while, because everything was going for them, but he also gave them the ability to go farther with their knowledge, and he placed for them and gave it to them in creation.
Right, yeah, we have to learn things, but, you know, like you're saying, we have to learn, but all the stuff is there that we need to use.
Stuff from the ore on the ground.
Right.
To the oil on the ground, to where we're on crude, to that. But we know that even some of Cain's, he was a, he knew how to work a metal. This was great. This is close to the front of the first part of Genesis.
Yeah.
Where he had,
right.
Metal.
Yeah. Right. Right. Karen Fitzwater.
Also, when this reminds me of the Tower of
Babel,
he changed everybody's voices, their languages. Well, I think in what you're showing and saying, he also, different people can live in different climates, because not everybody can live.
Yeah, and again, it just shows his hand in the whole thing. And that's what I think Paul is wanting us to think. When it rains outside, we should be thinking that God is providing for us. When we have food, well, we do it with our food. We give thanks for our food. I mean, that's the one thing we give thanks for. Can you think of anything that you give more thanks for more than food? I mean, I don't know if I can think of anything. I thank Him for salvation. I thank Him for forgiveness. But I don't think I do that three times a day, every day of the year. Man, we're really thankful for that. Because we know God is supplying those things. So again, that's telling us He's finely tuned the earth and its environment and everything that it does so we can live here. But somehow, evolutionists can look at all this and say, no, that's not the case at all. It's all a random accident. And at some point after the Big Bang is done expanding, many of them are saying it'll become the Big Crunch, and then start over again. And this may or may not happen again. So I don't know, I find it hard to believe that at one time I used to believe at least parts of evolution, but now I'm fully convinced that there's a God. Just as much as you're sitting here in front of me right now, I believe there's a God in heaven sitting down watching us. I have no doubt about that at all. Okay, so in conclusion, let's consider some things. Can you provide examples? That's why I forgot to have that up there. Can you provide examples of the anthropic principle? Just tell me some things that you believe makes life on Earth possible, and without it, we couldn't have life. In other words, assuming we have everything else in place, if we didn't have this one thing, like water.
About oxygen.
Oxygen. Okay. So we could have everything else. We could have all the minerals on the ground. We could be the right distance from the sun. We could have gravity. But if we don't have water, or I mean oxygen.
Even if the air pressure was different, we would die than what it is.
Okay, so we know we can withstand a little bit difference in pressure, because you know, see that did you ever used to wonder before we had all our space stuff and digital things, how did they know that Grant's Pass was what 900 something feet above sea level? And did you ever wonder, did somebody measure that or something?
That's how they got their basic elevation.
Well, how did we do it?
And chain and figured it out.
Oh, there you go. Well, I think it was actually air pressure. Well, it's the air pressure, yeah.
To actually know how high a hill is.
Uh-huh.
It was later just been, that has been a long time into our civilization before they discovered that they could measure air pressure and tell you what a point was.
Right, yeah. Right. So but in our times, before we had all the satellites and all that kind of stuff, you know, it was atmospheric pressure. Okay, so what else? What else makes life possible here?
When you talk about that kind of stuff, it reminds me of this sermon about the roads. How the roads
are
so perfectly mm-hmm. electrical. And after that, I keep thinking to myself, everything in this world is just so perfect. Down, the mathematicians have it down to hundreds and thousands of a percent of this, that, or another thing. You know, the Earth is tilted at 23.5 degrees to go around the sun. Now, if we were just even a half degree one way or the other, or almost anything, you keep saying it, that just goes through my mind about that rose. How, there's no way that everything could be this perfectly set up if there wasn't somebody to do it for us.
Yeah.
There's just no way that all of a sudden, randomly, bam, okay, everything's just perfect.
Right.
It just, to me, just does not compute.
Yeah. Okay, now, there are some things on the Earth, or that used to be on the Earth, that aren't here anymore, but we still have life. I mean, for example, the dinosaurs. But what happens if all of the bees of the Earth disappear? Well, you won't get stung anymore. No more honey? Okay. Okay. That's right. That they provide a huge service. I mean, even farmers, with all their technological savvy that they have today, still use bees for pollination. So again, you can have everything else in place, but what happens if we lose all the bees? And we are losing. I think, if I'm not mistaken, there are no more wild bees in America today. They're, all the bees you see are domesticated. Is that the right word to use, Dave?
Well,
he used to raise bees. That's why I'm asking.
They did have African, but the African wild bee was here up in north and had gotten as far north as about the coastal area, that part in California. But there has been a great decline in the bee population
right.
in the last 4 years.
Yeah, there's something killing them and they don't know what it is.
Right. They'll just die of fungi
right.
and a few of them. And infection, they can die.
Yeah. Now, let's say we have the bees, we have everything else, but what if we don't have any bacteria in our gut? That's right. So, there's another thing. You know, you have to, if you're the bacteria and your gut gets out of whack, you're sick. And, I mean, it can be really sick. Do you see what I'm saying? How often we could just, I think we could talk about this forever. You know, what if we couldn't see? What if we had lungs and a heart and kidneys and the ability to reproduce and everything else, but we can't see? Well, Don, I know people who are blind and they get along just fine. Okay, but I'm talking about the whole human race. All of us lose our sight tonight. Every human on the planet. Yeah, I wonder what that would do to life. So, yes, Tracy.
One thing that has always pointed me toward a designer rather than randomness is the simple existence of male and female in each species.
Right.
I know that there are people that have, they're asexual, but otherwise, the chances of as many species as we have developing or evolving, I don't know what the chances. But not only for that to happen, but then for enough for a male and female to develop that are different, but similar enough that they can reproduce.
Right.
But then even, one of my students was, because I had a cold this week, he said, well, does the baby have a cold since you have a cold? I'm like, I don't know. I mean, he's breathing liquid right now, so he's probably not coughing. He's like, what do you mean he's breathing liquid? How does he not breathe oxygen?
Yeah.
And, describing, the baby takes their first actual breath as soon as they hit the air, but they're actually getting oxygen right now. And just that whole process, I just don't, to me, that does not, there's no way, even if, let's say, one creature or creation could have evolved for as many different things as we have for a male and female in each, and for life to come from that, not just to have two different male and female, but for them to be able to create life, and for that, all the different ways that all these different species have. I mean, it's like mind-boggling to think that just happened. I just...
I could see if we were just one gender, the human race, or in all the animals on the earth, and we could reproduce, being asexual, I could see where the evolutionists would have an argument. But like you're saying, you have to have a male and a female who evolved at the same time and at the same rate, and they develop all the right parts, you know, and everything. And the female had to be able to grow a baby within her. I mean, all of that, it just this shouts out, there is a God. There's a, I just don't know how you can get away from that. Gene?
Look at the flowers. Most male and female.
Right.
They always produce the same. And that's the same type of thing you're talking about here. They always produce the same product.
Yeah, now let's assume that evolution did happen. It would make sense to me if a male and female of whatever species gets together, and one time they produce a certain kind of an animal, but the next time they produce something else. I mean, that makes sense for it to be random, because that's what evolution is. But what you're saying is it's ordered. There's the cosmos again. It's ordered. We're in a sense, we're like machines. You know, a factory, when you get all the parts right and all the machinery right and the conveyor belts and all that kind of stuff, you set it up to make a certain item. It doesn't just all of a sudden start making something different, and we're the same way.
How many different flowers are there?
Yeah, I don't know.
Mixed.
Right.
I hope
they're
the same. Yeah. And I think of the universe, there's our solar system, gives us our seasons.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of things on this earth that require those seasons, seeds that won't pollinate unless they go through a season, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it all happened.
That's right. Yeah. Does somebody else have their hand up? Thought I saw a hand. Okay. All right, so therefore, there is a God in heaven, and he knows you, and he cares for you. That's what we want to get across to people. Hopefully, as you talk with your neighbor or something like that, somebody at work, and you get in this discussion, ultimately that's where you want to take someone. There is a God. We're here. Why did he create us? Well, he must be thinking about us in a good and positive way. Okay? He wants you to live with him forever in heaven as his child. And again, that's what we want to get across to the average person. Okay. Let me pass out our next thing here, which we're going to have just a few minutes to get into. If you remember when we were looking at our other lesson about talking with atheists and evolutionists, that I gave you, three proofs that there is a God, the existence of nature, the existence of the Bible, and what I believe is the ultimate proof of God's existence. How do we know that there's a God? Well, in my mind, this is the ultimate one right here. Okay, is there one overwhelming argument that proves beyond all shadow of doubt that God exists? The existence of Jesus Christ. Think about it. Right? If you deny that Jesus existed, you might as well deny that Caesar Augustus existed, during whose reign Jesus was born. Jesus was born when this guy was on the throne, so to speak, of Rome. But no one denies that Caesar Augustus ever lived. But you do have a new breed of atheists now who say that Jesus never existed. Why would they deny one but affirm the other? You what? No. Although he's thought of very highly, the eighth month of the year is named after that Caesar. He was a great leader in a lot of ways. Christina.
I wonder if we're trying to say he doesn't think those descendants would get upset, you know, if somebody could trace back to thinking they were a descendant of his or whatnot, would they get upset in that thing?
Yeah. And really, and I just picked his name out of a hat because he could really just, anyone you've never met before, even people living today, but especially people who are long gone, if you've never met them before, they don't exist. Why not reason that way? How do you know Abraham Lincoln existed? Well, George, did you see him? You didn't see, you don't quite go back that far, yeah. Okay. All right. Okay, so next week I'm going to give you four quotations from ancient writers who are not friendly to Christianity, who make references to Christ.